Podcast. I'm Samuel Fredrickson.
And I'm Jason Moitoso.
And we're worlds apart.
No, we're not. We're just states apart, Sam.
Just a humble 400 miles.
That's nothing.
That's all. It's not. It's fine. Yeah, so this is our first time recording from two different states. I am in Washington, and Jason is in Idaho, right? That's where you are?
Sam, yes. Where you previously
said,
were. You are correct.
I almost said Oregon, and I was like,
what?
Wait a second. That's not right.
Not Why? Accurate.
Anyway, deceit. So we are recording for the first time in about a month? Is
yeah,
that right?
That's pretty close to it. I mean, how was your move?
It was fine. It was good. We got all settled over here. We're in the basement, and it's just like we had planned, if not even better.
Dark and dreary.
It rains like
Sad.
Every day. It's fantastic.
Oh, dear.
It's so good. It's so beautiful. It's exactly what I want. I sit on the porch and listen to the rain as I read my books, and it's just, it's like, it's idyllic in my mind. I don't know. Some people might think it sounds bad, but.
So, quarantine's got you just fine.
I'm loving this.
You.
This is my element.
Yeah.
I mean, I would
As
like to go
body.
Out and I'd like to go somewhere. I'd like to do something, but whatever. That's life. It's a little unnerving being in Washington State where it's like, oh, there's a lot more.
Substantially worse than Idaho.
Yeah, but that's okay. I'm sure it's fine. How's it in Idaho?
Beachy.
Does the land miss me? Does it cry out for me in the night?
No, but every time I drive past your street, I'm like, Sam's not down there anymore.
I know.
That
we
makes
take
me a
up
sad.
Like we take up like psychic space in each other's minds. Everyone you've ever known, they become a part of the landscape, and then when they're gone, it's just a little sad. It's like when my brother moved two streets down. He used to be basically on my street, and then he moved down to Vista. And I would drive by his apartment complex and be like, he's not there.
Yeah,
even though
so now I'm
only
like, oh,
three
it's,
minutes
it's past
away.
Sam's house. Oh, wait.
It's past the void.
It's not Sam's house anymore.
It's past
I don't know what it
nothing.
Is.
Nothing. Well, it sounds like it'll be fine. It sounds like it's going to be A-okay.
Oh, we're going to make it.
We're going to make it. Let's move on from this. Because
right.
a lot of
let's
people
start doing some dark
are using
rituals.
Podcasts as escapism right now.
Right.
And so I'd hate to break that. In the terms of escapism, if you haven't been hearing it, if you've been skipping the mid-show break, which I understand it happens, whatever, feel free to head over to the Patreon. Everything is available to everybody for the next few weeks. Even if you're not a patron, we've opened up all of the bonus episodes and stuff just so you can have something to keep your minds off of. But today,
we're finally talking about the thing that I want to talk about.
We're starting to talk about what Jason wanted to talk about this whole time, which is dark magic.
Summoning demons.
Kind of, yeah. And this episode and or these episodes, because this might turn into two, this is just going to be us kind of examining.
Sam.
Well, just. It just
Come on.
Depends on how fast we can get through this. And that's really on you, isn't it?
Yeah. It's going to be too, bud.
All right.
Fair warning.
All right. In any case, we're just going to kind of give you a understanding of Crowley's magical system and break down its most important work, the Book of the Law. So this is basically an interruption. We've been looking at Crowley's life. And his life has brought us yet again to the peak of a philosophical summit that we need to look down from and say, okay, what does the landscape look like here before we can keep on keeping on? This is the turning point. This is the point where Crowley really does become and really leans into this idea of like the wickedest man in the world and the great beast and is doing more than just like playing at magic and writing silly poetry, even though he continues to do both.
Who is he, me?
It's the Do you write poetry?
No.
Jason, it's okay if
It'll
you do.
It'll never
bud.
See the dawn of light. The light
and,
of dawn.
And yeah, and we
the
can
light of
we
day?
Can
all of it.
We can if you'd like, bud, we
what
can
you do
make
in the night?
A mid-show break. We'll take a mid-show break and just have a poetry reading from Jason. If anybody wants that, write in and I'll make it happen even if it's not his own poetry. He can read some yeets. In any case, hello. Yes, so this is the point in Crowley's life where everything turns. So we're going to spend an episode or two kind of looking at this philosophically and then see how it plays out over the next, oh God, I hope just maybe two more, three more episodes. Guys, I'm sorry. I didn't know this was going to be a 10 to 12 part series. If I did, I never would have done this to you. I just wouldn't have. But
I mean, we could have just cut stuff out.
No, that's not really how we operate.
Did we need the backstory? I know it's not.
Yeah. That's people's complaint is we're very long-winded. That's fine. So it's not even a complaint. Some people like that. I don't, but some people do.
Okay. Anyway.
So the year, if you've forgotten, is 1904. The dates.
It's 2020.
Are the...
What are you talking about?
But wouldn't it be nice if it wasn't?
I'm gonna be honest. I'd take 2019 over again.
I know. We all thought it was the worst it could get. Just like 2018.
Yeah.
Just like 2017 and 2016. We're like, it can't get any worse.
Oh, but it can.
It can. The Mountain Goats have this song that I listen to every New Year's Day that says, I'm going to make it through this year if it kills me. And I think this is the first year that might actually stand a fighting chance.
Yeah, but the gas prices are so cheap. It's wonderful.
Not over here. Frickin' liberals taxing everything, which I'm totally benefiting from because I have free healthcare over here. I don't have to pay a dime for anything. It's amazing. But because
bastard.
Of that, my gas is $2.50 a gallon. It's terrible.
$2.50. I mean, okay. That's like normal prices. It's
but
like
it does.
Down
it does
to,
mean that I'm not going to have to pay $1,200 to get my wisdom teeth out in a couple weeks.
We're absolutely under like $2, which is pretty.
That's wild. So,
oh yeah.
On yes, we're back.
The dates.
The book of the yes, April 8th, 9th, and 10th of the year 19,004.
Would you say that these are the wickedest days of the year?
No. No.
Oh.
No, that's definitely Halloween. I don't know what the wickedest days of the year. Yeah, we can go ahead and make it this one. Yeah, why not?
Are these holy days in...
They are.
Philemic.
I believe there are... So, as we'll see, the revelation consists of, like, some of the technical details of, like, do this then and do this now. And so it sets up different feast days for... adherence of Crowley's system, and I believe one of the periods is the 8th, 9th, and 10th of April every year. So,
interesting.
Fun.
When you say feast now, days, I'm assuming it's not what you and I would be considering a feast. Is it?
No.
Or is it a little...
No, feast days are... It's basically a... That's just how holy days are referred to. So, like, the Judaism, they have feast days. Christianity has feast days. You don't typically actually feast. I mean, sometimes you do. But, yeah, that's typically just the holy days,
okay.
As it were.
I apologize.
Yeah.
Anyway, so April 8th, 9th, and 10th of
1904. April 8th, 9th, and 10th. And you'll remember that we ended the last episode with Crowley receiving a message from his wife, Rose, who was... speaking or being spoken through by an entity named Eos, right?
Right.
Eos, the entity. So basically, every day, he would go in at noon, he would spend exactly 1 hour, and then he'd be done. And in that time, he just transcribes what he hears. Theoretically, it sounds like, to me, after doing a little more research, it sounds pretty definitive that Rose, at least in his retellings of this, is not necessarily in the room, but rather that he is getting dictation from a disembodied spirit that is in the corner. And it's kind of a Persian sort of spirit is what he says. Kind of a... So there's that. Right off the bat, I think it's interesting to note the similarities to... the reception and the recital of the Quran that occur in this. So Crowley, as we've kind of seen over the last six episodes, Crowley kind of just moves through
That's
different
it? That's
religious...
That's all it's been?
I know.
I thought we
and
switched
yet
to be
feels
a,
like eternity.
A Crowley-only podcast.
I actually deleted the other 117 episodes from our feed because it's just not fair for anybody to assume that we're ever going to talk about anything other than Aleister Crowley ever again. So you
Perfect.
Actually can't listen to those anymore. Crowley makes his way through different philosophical and religious systems. He starts out in Christianity. He moves through, by virtue especially of his time in the Golden Dawn and the mysticism of it all, he is acquainted with Judaism and mystical Judaism. He moves through Buddhism, especially in the East, different things. So his stated goal, kind of, as he and Rose were in Cairo, was to learn more about Islam, as it were. Granted, he at this point had kind of become disenchanted with the whole idea that any one system was going to be able to bring him to any sort of eternal understanding or conception, but he was like, hey, I'm here, I might as well learn about it. And in the midst of his learning, he has this experience, which, for anyone who's not familiar, is I would say, evocative of the way that Muhammad received the Quran from the angel Gabriel. Now, the Quran was transmitted over the course of 23 years, so that's quite a difference. But the same core tenet of there being some sort of higher entity that physically spoke to the individual, to the prophet, who then wrote down word for word what was said, that is a peculiar function. And I just thought it was interesting that, kind of like we mentioned dispensationalism in the last episode and how that relates to a different religious philosophy Crowley was acquainted with, it just kind of sounds very similar here. And I don't mean to say that. Go ahead.
But Crowley himself, he seems to do this with a lot of religions, or at least ideas that he like comes across and quote-unquote studies, is then he gets affected by it miraculously because he's the chosen one.
Right. And he just to gets some extent, it.
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, it's not out of character for him to receive something like that in the same premise that a prophet had in the past.
Exactly. It's absolutely not. And it's not even necessarily, I would say, any sort of a mark of like charlatanism or dishonesty on Crowley's part. I think that if he's aware of what he's doing, which I'd be surprised if he wasn't, he's doing it because it is an homage to different systems, all of which, again, going back to his extremely Rosicrucian roots, all of these different systems are necessitated by the fact that they each have just a tiny bit of truth that is meant to point people to the higher truth behind everything. So it's basically like he's just grabbing as he goes. He's just like shopping down the alley at Albertsons, and he goes down the Buddhism aisle and he takes like self-annihilation and puts it in the basket. And then he goes down the Muslim aisle and he takes like direct word for word transition of Holy Scripture and he puts it in the basket. And then he gets to the checkout person, and that's where the metaphor for falls apart, because I don't know what he uses to pay for it or anything like that.
So what he's telling me is he's just doing like an Eastern fusion. That's what he's cooking up.
Oh, God.
And his cauldron. I'm assuming he uses a cauldron at some point in time. So,
you know, I'm not sure if that's true yet. We'll have to see.
I'm going to be real honest, though. If you have a cast iron pot, like a Dutch oven, oh, man, those things are
amazing.
That's
a cauldron.
Yeah.
You're there. You've got it. Make yourself a stew.
I'm a warlock, let's be honest. Practically there.
Now, the Book of the Law, which is the name of these three revelations that he received day after day after day, it functions as the cornerstone of Crowley's own unique magical system, which is known as thelema. Now, thelema is a Greek word. It's found multiple places in both the Greek New Testament as well as the Greek translation of the Hebrew Bible, which is called the Septuagint. It is translated as will, and our eagle-eared listeners will remember that Crowley references will a number of times previous to this in his coming up and his development and learning, especially, most importantly, I would say, when he makes his act of will to the secret chiefs in order to be initiated into their mysteries and be put in contact with their representatives.
So do you think that this word was chosen because of his hermetic roots?
Yes, I absolutely think this was chosen.
That's probably the root to the naming structure.
Yes. And I think as we really look at the word linguistically, I think it's an astounding word that is exactly adequate and correct for what he's trying to get. That's the thing about Crowley is like I personally am highly ascribed to the idea that he's just a spy who is also a hedonist. And I don't know that he believes too much in what he's doing in any sort of a real sense, but that, and I could be wrong about that.
I just think he's crazy.
See, and that's fine too. But there is no denying that he is a very intelligent person who is able to who is gifted and able to take these different things and really use them and warp them and create his own systems out of them. And thelema, the word itself linguistically, is a wonderful example of that, because although it does mean will, it is a will that is different than the willpower of a human being, for instance. It's a divine or external will. It's something that subjects something
like
to
fate.
It.
Would that be more kind correct?
Kind of
like this fate, this cosmic will, to where fate, or like a destiny, like something of that nature.
Fate would be a good example, or even for any of our theists out there, just to say the will of God itself, as opposed to the will of man, they're substantially different. See, the will of man is something that man subjects to himself. It is something that I am able to use in order to get things done. I can will myself to do my science paper.
It's more concrete, sort of. Does that make more sense? Like, it's more something that we can perceive.
Yeah, it is.
Or like
something
that
we have
So like you can almost say any cosmic event is the will of something else, something higher than what we are. But my will and your will, those are very grounded concepts instead
right.
of being kind of aloof.
Yes, they're very much more tangible. They're very much more
right.
known.
That's more
and
that's
able
more
to
where
be
I was
observed.
Going
with yeah. It. Yeah, that makes sense. So, yeah, our human wills are things that we subject to ourselves. Thelema, the Greek word itself, is used to describe something that subjects others to it. So
okay.
The word in ancient Greek outside of biblical sources is rare, but when it is used, it is either used to describe the will of either God, a monotheistic God or polytheistic gods, or the will of sexual desire, which was something that man in that philosophy, man was subjected to his desire. It was not subjected to him. So again, human will, which is not what the word for would be for thelema. I don't know what that word would be in the Greek. Human will is that which is subjected to us. Thelema is that which we are subjected to, whether that's a monotheistic god, whether that's a polytheistic god, or whether that's cravings beyond our control. Does
okay.
that
yeah.
track?
Yeah, absolutely.
All right. So in the Septuagint, the Greek translation of the Hebrew Bible, it is only ever used in relation to either God's self or to God, the God-fearing people in their will and desire for God. It is also used sometimes for the kingly will as well because, as we mentioned, it is a will that subjects others to it. It is authority through will. Now, in the New Testament, it is only ever used to refer to the will of God famously in the Lord's Prayer where it says, "Thy will be done." Thus, for Crowley to be practicing thelema, the overtones of his system should begin to be elucidated for us. It's going to refer to the striving to become like God or the striving for God in some way. And it probably has to do with sex, because of course it does, because it's Aleister Crowley and everything in his life has to do with sex.
Well, I think that's mostly because of how rebellious against society he is. And I mean, we are talking about turn of the 20th century,
mm-hmm.
which I assume is very more repressive than today.
Yes. Obviously. Yes. And there's definitely a part of this that is Crowley's own countercultural acting out. Like, we'll see that he makes absolutely no qualms about it in the Book of the Law itself. But what he does is he, as we'll see, he makes sex central to his entire philosophy beyond just standing in opposition. So, and if that wasn't a good enough, I don't know, indicator for anybody, not too terribly soon, but either later in this episode or in the next one, it's going to get a little weird, and then it's going to keep getting a little weird. So I'll do my best to call those out right before they happen. It won't be too bad in these two episodes, but I'm sure after this, we're going to, it's going to get, I'm probably going to have to mark these explicit, and that's fine. It happens.
Yeah.
So on a more philosophical level, the act of thelema harkens back to Crowley's astonishing experience after just 2 weeks of doing Buddhist stuff with Alan Bennett, who I always think of as the sixth Beatle. I don't know why, other than he's just an Englishman who's really infatuated with the Eastern philosophy, and so he pretends he's a Swami. Kind of like George Harrison.
So, no, he's the hipster Beatle.
Yes, yes.
Because he did it before the 60s.
He did do it. He's the archetype. Frickin', and all of this is. That's what you just...
So wait, are you just telling me that the Beatles are satanic?
Of course they are. Led Zeppelin, the Beatles, the Mama and the Papas. They're all satanic. They're not. But I hope at some point in the future, it may not be at the end of the series. It was originally going to be the fourth episode of a four-episode series, was going to be us talking about how Crowley has influenced pop culture and especially like music and all of that. Because like Jimmy Page, the guitarist from Led Zeppelin, loved Aleister Crowley, like built his, or bought his house and lived in it. So we'll do that later.
That's not weird.
Jimmy Page is a weird guy. He's fine. In any case, if one is practicing the kind of will that subjects one to itself, then one becomes and is that kind of will that one is subjected to. In essence, it is the unification of the object and the subject, the dhyana, which Crowley experienced after his 2 weeks of really giving it a go at Buddhism, right before he decided to go big game hunting. Because of course he did. But if that is all that thelema is, if it is only essentially saying my will be done and I am going to do whatever I want to do, then in that case, it is essentially just a sort of mystical libertarianism. In fact, do what thou wilt could very well be the slogan of a libertarian candidate in 2020, if anyone's looking for one. But it wouldn't require some sort of a magical system. You could just do it. Does that make sense?
Okay. Yes.
I
don't have to perform rituals for this, essentially, right?
Well, if that's all it was, if do what thou wilt, which is the tagline of thelema,
right.
If that's all it was, then exactly, you wouldn't have to do rituals or anything. You could just do whatever you wanted to do. And I think that that is one of the ways that people look at thelema and they get it completely wrong. Thelema in modern day Satanism, which grew out of thelema, it is not about necessarily the moral relativism to say that like, oh, nothing matters, and so I can just do whatever I want. It is something higher than that. See, thelema still acknowledges the externality of the will, capital W, will, while simultaneously giving its practitioners ownership of the will. The will is still something that we are subjected to, and yet we are able to discover it and make it our own. And this is what Crowley refers to as the mystical concept of true will.
So see, essentially like an enlightenment of will.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. See, I think it's very very, very helpful to think of true will and will in general akin to the Chinese philosophical concept of the Tao, which is elaborated in the Tao Te Ching, which Crowley is very, very well aware of at this point in his life and would even go on to produce his own adaptation of later in life. The Tao is the underlying pattern of reality. Why do birds sing? Because of the Tao. Why does a tree grow? It is tau. Why is the gravitational constant of the universe 6.67408 times 10 to the negative 11th power times m to the third power times kg to the negative first power times s to the negative second power? Because of tau. It is tau. It simply is the way things are. Does that make sense?
It does on a grander scale. The will being replacing tau. It is the will of nature. It is the will of the cosmos for things to occur the way they do without human interaction.
Exactly. And so when we look at true will, essentially we're taking that tau, that universal pattern, and we are bundling it down, we're contracting it down into a single individual. The true will of an individual is their own pattern of reality. It's not a divine purpose for life. It's not necessarily like your destiny.
That's actually a really interesting perspective because, well, it is kind of stating that the way that you perceive your life is your own will, right? Am I following that right? That's kind of, not to give them too much credit, but a kind of an enlightened perspective.
Right.
Because
I think he was an enlightened fella.
I mean, yeah, but like the age old whatever saying that, you know, no one is the villain of their own story. It's again like being able to have that perspective on your own quote unquote will is basically like, again, like how you're living your own life. And that is kind of liberating to an extent where you have some level of control of how that direction proceeds.
Yeah. Yeah. So destiny and will, when we look at it, destiny is more of like a quest, right? It's following the steps of your life in order to obtain a great reward, even if that great reward is simply happiness or a sense of fulfillment. But we act outside. Well, I don't know. I don't want to get into destiny too much. But rather, you are, when we look at true will, you are supposed to be, true will is that which you are supposed to be because being it is what you are. There is no reward system. There is no like, oh, this is something you have to do. In fact, this is something that you are and you have to be. Thus, the expounding of the will as the whole of the law is not an excuse to act selfishly or to harm others. And in fact, Thelemites will be the first to tell you that impinging on another's will, especially by violent means, can never be an act of your own true will. It can never be that way. So I think that that's a difference between like destiny. Some people, like, I don't know, you could say like, oh, it was Brutus's destiny to kill Julius Caesar. He was destined to do it. Or like the guy who shot Franz Ferdinand.
Well, is that where the will and your will collide?
The will and your will are the same will.
But if you're not enlightened, you don't have that connection, right?
Correct. Yeah. If you're not enlightened, if you're not a Thelemite, you're not following your true will anyway.
Right.
And so you'll do anything and it's whatever.
Right. You cannot discover what your true will is unless you're going down this path.
Exactly. Exactly. And it's like when we think of, what was the guy's name who shot Franz Ferdinand? Do you remember?
No, I don't.
I don't know if you've ever heard that story, but that is a story of like full out. That is like a story in my mind of like destiny. Basically,
so
he and the rest of the Black Hand.
He misses his original attempt. And then later on that day, he by happenstance comes across the Archduke and then is able to kill him.
He's correct? Like his. Yeah. So he misses his shot. He throws away his gun and runs away. He decides to go and get a sandwich of all things. Ferdinand, in the last moment, decides to change his course so that he can go to the hospital, so that he can visit the people that did get hit in the bullets instead. His car breaks down immediately in front of the cafe that that guy is stepping out of in that exact moment. And at that point, I guess he didn't throw his gun away. He just runs away because he grabs his gun and he shoots him right then and there. So that's one of those situations where it's like, oh, well, it was just destiny. If you're going to go down that route, that's just destiny.
Right.
But true will is never going to function that way because it, A, takes away your ability to act. It makes you the actor. It makes you the player in somebody else's highest scheme. And not to mention, it also takes away, it also causes others to do violence to others, which is a central tenet of not necessarily doing that.
But
so,
don't you have to make like blood sacrifices for?
We're gonna get there.
Magic rituals. I mean, like that seems like it's about to to shoot itself in its own foot.
There are some different parts of this that are very contradictory, which I think is appropriate for the man that Aleister Crowley is. We've said it in almost every episode. The dude's a walking contradiction. He's a Protestant Jacobite. He's a legitimist who doesn't believe in the English crown. So like he's a very,
this is who we're working
contradictory
with.
Person. Yeah, exactly. So the magical work of Thelema is to assist a practitioner with the discovery of their true will and with perfecting themselves in order to follow it throughout the course of their life without deviating from it. Now, for some of us, that might mean that you're like the best accountant in the frickin' world, like that you're the absolute best. Crowley, as this developed, even talked about like trying to test children to figure out their true will so that they could be placed on the path through their life in order to follow that will at a young age. And that means that some people are going to be lower working class people and other people are going to be aristocracy. And that's just kind of how it works in Crowley's mind. As you can imagine, he would think, and he knew, for instance, he knew that his own true will was something really special. He is the most special, smartest boy. So,
well, he's the one that figured it out, so it makes sense to me.
Exactly. He had recently begun calling himself, right before receiving the Book of the Law, which I promise we're about to dive into, he called himself the Chiokan, or the Chief Beast or King Beast. After this, he would refer to himself, after this being after the revelation of the Book of the Law, he would refer to himself in his magical diaries as Achaia, which he claims was a metathesis, whatever that means, of his own name that translates to the God Beast. Your true will might be to be a struggling actor all of your life and to die at age 27 of a drug overdose. But Crowley's true will is to be the God Beast. Well, you know.
Okay. So at this point in time, though, before we get into the Book of the Law, do you think he is still working for the British government?
Yes. Oh, yes. So yeah, he's a spy all throughout this.
You believe even through this section, he is still a spy.
He's still a spy.
Okay.
And that's where when we get past this episode and the next episode and we get kind of back into the narrative of his life, we'll start kind of throwing those spy references back in. But okay. He's definitely still a spy.
All right.
And will be for the rest of his life.
Lovely. Okay. So yeah. Book of the Law.
Yes. So we'll be getting into like the practice of Thelema and some of the rituals and stuff like that later on. Again, this is kind of just to give you a basic understanding of the philosophy of Thelema and the cosmology and metaphysics of the Book of the Law, which again is that fundamental text. Now, we already spoiled it. We already told you the climax of the Book of the Law, which is "Do what thou wilt shall be the whole of the law." But there's a lot of other stuff in here that's really quite fascinating. So the book is naturally divided into three different chapters, one for each day that the recitation took place, and each of the chapters comes from a different divine source. The first comes from a deity known as Nuit, the second comes from a deity known as Hadit, and the third comes from Ra-Hor-Kut. Ra-Hor-Kut is just a manifestation of Horus, and so that's what I'm going to call him from here on out, is just Horus, because that's a lot easier to pronounce. So
this is just like a 45-page...
It's not even 45 pages. It's like 13 pages.
Oh.
It's a very small book. Okay. It's, I think the total verses in the book probably come out to about 220 or 230 or so. So it's something you can sit down and read in the course of like 10 minutes. It's wild. Really not too, yeah, okay. It's not too bad. Now, anybody who's going to do that, I cannot overemphasize the importance of having some sort of a commentary. Crowley in his life produced two different commentaries, one called the Old and one called the New. They are both compounded or compiled in a volume called The Law is for All by Aleister Crowley. And in that, he takes and breaks down verse by verse what it's saying and what it means in regards to the Old and the New commentary. So that's a great place to start if you're looking at this. We're going to go through a few different of the highlights, but we are in no way going to take this verse by verse, because that would take days, if not months, of our lives. So here
we go. I thought you just said it was 13 pages.
Huh?
I thought you just said it was 13 pages.
Yeah, but if you sit down at Crowley's freaking, let me see if I can find it, Crowley's commentary on it, The Law is for All.
Just everything.
Let me just get a page count. It's 170 pages just for these 200 verses or so.
And that's his, and like, each, reflection on
what it actually means.
Okay.
Yeah. So it takes a while to get through all of it. Or at least to try to even begin to understand all of it. Okay. So, knew it is how this opens. Basically, it says, had the revelation or the vision of Nuit. Now, Nuit is Our Lady of the Stars, to give her kind of a ripoff of like a Marian title, right? Apparitions of Mary are often called Our Lady of Fatima, for instance. This is Nuit, Our Lady of the Stars, as she is called by Crowley. Now, she is an interpretation of the Egyptian goddess Nut. And everything that Crowley is going to do in the Book of the Law is related to Egyptian religion in one way or another.
Okay, so who is Nut? Who's the, what does she preside over?
Nut is the goddess, or even necessarily the personification of the sky. She is the boundless expanse of eternity. So Horus, his domain is the sky, just like Ra is either the sun, or his domain typically is the sun, but Nut is the sky itself. And so thus Nuit is also the sky itself. It's just a little bit of a different spelling, basically.
Okay.
Now, the night sky addresses Crowley, and the first words of substance that she speaks are in verse 3 and 4. She says, quote, every man and every woman is a star. Every number is infinite. There is no difference, unquote. Jason, what do you think that means?
I think it means we're all special.
Yeah, yeah, that's good. That's good. That's essentially what it means. These are the fundamental truths of Thelema, which does justify the formation of the system in pursuant to one's true will. Every individual is a star, is a unique, eternal being. See, the stars have long been associated with the gods, going back to ancient Sumeria, beyond that in through the, or not beyond that, but after that, the Hebrew Bible, all the way up through to our present day understanding of astrology. It's not a coincidence that when we look up in the sky, we say, oh, there's Jupiter, there's Saturn, there's Venus. The gods have always been associated with the stars. In this text, we are being told that you and I are the stars. We are the gods that people have worshipped in the past and continue to worship to this day.
Which kind of makes sense with the idea that no numbers matter, everything is infinite. It kind of harkens to me like that fourth dimension where time is irrelevant. Time is essentially a construct of how we view things. While saying one and two are both infinite and all numbers are infinite, mm-hmm. kind of the same kind of interaction and connection I get with the idea of like time and ourselves.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. And you know what it's getting at there is that when you look at numbers, the number two is not one plus one. One plus one equals two, but two is not two ones put together. Seven is not three and four put together. It's seven. Same thing with every single number. They are all their own individual entities, so long as you believe that they exist in any sort of actual way, which is another philosophical debate going back thousands of years. But in any case, this is an inversion and an interesting opposition to the Buddhism that Crowley claimed to have mastered and been the true Buddhist that everybody should aspire to be. Because, of course, in Buddhism, every single thing is dependent. There is no independent entity. Whereas here, every single person, at the very least, is an independent entity. So a fun little turning it around there. Now, in verse 5, Nuit adjures who she calls the warrior lord of Thebes to help her. This is a reference to Crowley, or better said, a reference to Crowley's priestly either alter ego or past life or both, which is an individual known as Ankh-Afna-Khonsu. This is the name that's found on the stele that Rose identified in the museum as the image of Horus. It is addressed to Nut, just as it is also addressed to Hadit and Horus. All three of those entities exist on the stele, and they are being served on the stele by that priest, Ankh-Afna-Khonsu, who was a priest of Manthu called the Lord of Thebes. So, verse 8. That's the next important verse. Another very important one for Thelemic Thelemic thought is, quote, "The cobs is in the coup, not the coup in the cobs," unquote.
What?
Yeah, I know. I agree. What are you talking about? So the cobs, this is K-H-A-B-S. This is an ancient Egyptian word for star. This is one's true self operating with their true will. The coup, K-H-U, is one's ego and personality. Thus, we are eternal. The cobs is in the coup, not the coup in the cobs. We are eternal. We, as individuals, exist behind and within our personalities. Our personalities are not eternal. They are refractions of the eternal aspect. They are shaped by our eternal essence, but they are not ourselves. Now, in Western thought, our personalities are basically our stand-ins for ourselves. When we think about after death, for instance, if we're talking about ghosts or anything like that, the key thing about them is that they sound the same. They have the same vocabulary, the same mannerisms. You know, people say, oh, she said this word, which is always how my mother would say things, or he made this motion, which is always how my father used to move, that sort of a thing.
Right.
But what Crowley is saying is that it is not that personality that is eternal. And this is important because it harkens back to this idea basically of reincarnation, is that we are some eternal thing that is experiencing reality differently every time, and yet there is something eternal within us.
It's almost like a different layer of us, a different representation.
Yes, exactly.
If you sat 20 people in a room and described something to them and had them draw it out or sculpt it or something, everyone would have something that's a little bit different.
Yeah. If you think about it, saying the cobs is in the coup, not the coup in the cobs, is essentially saying the body is in the clothing, not the clothing in the body. I am not my shirt. I may choose my shirt to accentuate different parts of me or because it's something that I like or whatever.
Self-expression, yeah, yeah.
Exactly, but if I take off the shirt, I'm still me. And when I shred my personality moving from this life beyond, I am still myself. So, okay. Verse 9 adjudicates us to, quote, worship the cobs and behold my, or Nuit's, light shed over you. Worship the self, the true will that informs who we are or not even informs, but it is who we are. Worship the self. I tried to explain it. I can't explain it any more than just those three words without just saying it over and over again. So now verse 12 states, come forth, O children, under the stars or the cobs, the will. Come forth under the will and take your fill of love. This mirrors one of the culminating verses in this chapter, which is verse 57, which says, quote, invoke me under my stars. Love is the law, love under will. So when we're talking about love, Crowley is explicitly talking about sex. He's not only talking about sex, but that is the primary function of what he means by love. Not just like, oh, I'm going to do something nice. I'm going to give myself to someone.
The physical interaction of love.
The physical act of love is what Crowley's trying to get at here. Yes. Now, his own comment on verse 12, which again is the come forth under the stars and take your fill of love, says, quote, the key of the worship of Nu, the uniting of consciousness with an infinite space by the exercise of love. And on verse 57, he states, love under the will, no casual pagan love, not love under fear as the Christians do, but love magically directed and used as a spiritual formula, unquote. So, this is the seed, the beginning of the way that sex is going to be used in Thelema, which we will, unfortunately, get a lot more into by the time this is all done.
So
but
it,
for
it's
now,
somewhere in between casual pagan love,
exactly,
and Christian love.
So, and again, in Crowley's idea, in Crowley's thought, Crowley sees in paganism, Crowley sees love being used, love, or even not necessarily being used. He sees basically unchanneled, unfocused sexual activity that does not lead to anything.
Barbarianism.
Yeah.
Essentially.
Yeah.
Not an uncivilized use of love.
Of the tech of love.
Yeah.
Christianity, on the other end, he sees love, again, not used for any sort of a spiritual or edification process, but rather sex being used as a necessity for the survival of the human race, but, as he says, something to be feared, something to be to run away from. Like, Crowley is, in my opinion, although he is, like, manipulative and not very good, he is laying the foundation work of, like, a very much sex positive movement wherein he's still trying to say, okay, this is important. This is something that matters in a big way, but it's something that should and ought to be interacted with in a much more normal, real, everyday life sort of thing. We should take away the taboo, which is exactly what the entirety of Thelema is about, is not only removing those taboos, but actually using those taboos to shame those who hold the taboos, as we'll talk about. Is that we good?
Yeah, I'm following.
All right.
You got me.
Now, another important part of the theory of Thelema comes through in verse 15. Quote, now ye shall know that the chosen priest and apostle of infinite space is the prince priest, the beast, and in his woman called the Scarlet Woman is all power given. They shall gather my children into their fold. They shall bring the glory of the stars into the hearts of men, unquote. So, if you had to guess, who's the priest and apostle of infinite space, the prince priest, the beast? Who is that?
Well, it's himself.
It's Aleister Crowley.
He's exactly. The chosen one.
He's The chosen
to
one.
To bring balance to the Force.
That is actually very quite true.
Yeah.
That is extremely true.
Yep.
That is how exactly that balance, as we'll see. Now, the Scarlet Woman is Rose Kelly Crowley. Now, the Scarlet Woman, this term, is another allusion to the Book of Revelation, just like the Beast is. In chapter 17, it states, quote, "I saw a woman sit upon a scarlet-colored beast, full of names of blasphemy, having seven heads and ten horns. And the woman was arrayed in purple and scarlet color, and decked with gold and precious stones and pearls, having a golden cup in her hand full of abominations and filthiness of her fornication. And upon her forehead was a name written, Mystery, Babylon the Great, the mother of harlots and abominations of the earth. And I saw the woman drunken with the blood of the saints and with the blood of the martyrs of Jesus. And when I saw her, I wondered with great admiration." Unquote. So that's who the beast consort Rose Kelly is. Now, what's interesting is that in Crowley's mind, in the comment, the beast and the Scarlet Woman are not individuals so much as they are archetypes. He says they're titles of office, the same way that the president is not a person, it's a title, it's an office that one inhabits. Now, he then goes to immediately say, but as far as I can tell, there is only one beast. So for him, it's a fusing. And it comes back to basically the idea that he is the reincarnation of this priest that was performing these rites back in ancient Thebes. He is the beast because he is over and over and over and over and over again. That's what his cobs is the cobs of the beast. Whereas the Scarlet Woman, that is more of a coup. That is something that is affected, that someone puts on and becomes for a time. Okay. So there's that. Now, the other part of all of this, kind of like you just mentioned, the what did you say? Something about the opposites or the balance of the Force. Yeah.
Correct.
So in Crowley's estimation, the Scarlet Woman is the balancing female force, balancing female sexual force that unites with the male force to create a unity instead of a duality. And we'll be talking more about this a little later on. But they don't create two beings coming together for a moment in one, they create one new being. So, spoiler alert, that will surprise no one. As we mentioned, the beast is the cobs. The Scarlet Woman seems to be the coup, because he counted, by the time he's writing his second comment, which I'm not sure exactly when that is, but it's a bit longer. By the time he writes his second comment, he has counted no less than seven Scarlet Women in his life, and Rose is the very first of them all. So
how does he identify them?
Basically by their either opportunity, their potential, or their actual acts that take Thelema and advance it, and advance his magical system. So some of the, actually six of the seven Scarlet Women that he notes are failures in some way or another. The final one that he was with at the time of writing, he says she has succeeded thus far. But some of them failed, like Rose Kelly, who fails after this, as we'll see when we kind of get back to the biographical part of his life. There are others who fail before the work even starts, and yet he knows they had the potential to advance themselves and the work.
Ah, okay.
Okay.
So it's really fancies. Got it.
Yeah, yeah.
Pretty much.
So, verses 22 and 23, quote, "Now therefore I am known to thee by my name Nuit, and to him by a secret name which I give him, when at last he knoweth me. Since I am infinite space and the infinite stars thereof, do ye also thus bind nothing. Let there be no difference made among you between any one thing and any other thing, for thereby there cometh hurt. But whoso availed in this, let him be the chief of all." So this is another reference to the elimination of the sense of duality. Crowley is advocating, or Iwas through Crowley, is advocating that we do not esteem things different, but rather we see the unity of all things, which again is that contradiction. Every person is a star, every person is eternal, and every number is infinite, and yet the constellations are made up of multiple stars that are dependent on those stars, and yet they are also eternal constellations of stars as well. So again, it's this kind of contradictory back and forth that really is, I believe, meant to kind of stretch the mind and get it to think outside the box, for lack of a better term. Crowley makes an interesting note regarding the word hurt that is used. He states that the French antecedent to the word hurt, which I'm not going to pronounce because I can't speak French, it means simply to knock something against something else. And thus, if one does not recognize a division or a duality, one can not knock something against something else, since there is only one thing. So it
sounds like this is, sorry, primarily like just very philosophical.
It's very philosophical.
About the self.
Yes. Yes, it's very philosophical. Again, Crowley, Thelema is not necessarily a religion as much as it is a philosophical system. But the problem is that it does incorporate action. And what is a religion but a philosophical system that incorporates action? So who knows from there?
Right.
It's up in the air. Now, another really big part of all of this and of Kabbalah, of Rosicrucianism, of the Golden Dawn, of Thelema is numerology. Numerology is a huge part of all of this. We'll talk a little bit more about that in our next episode, because it plays a bigger role near the beginning of chapter 3. But all throughout this, there are these little numerological footnotes, things like where it says the number of Nuit is found to be 6 and 50. The creation of the world is revealed as the appearance of a false duality, something which we are supposed to overcome to realize that the spiritual represented by Nuit is in harmony and concert with the material, which is represented by Hadit, which we'll see a little bit more. So he's also throwing all sorts of just different numbers at us all the time. And it's very decentering. It's very decentering. That's honestly, I spent like, I don't know, 3 or 4 hours on just one of these numbers. I spent researching it to try to understand what he was trying to say. And then I finally kind of got it, I think. And that'll come again in a little bit. So we're getting there. Jason, you doing okay?
I'm hanging in there, bud.
You're hanging in there?
All right, yeah, I'm trying to like, from just my knowledge base, think of why these numbers matter, because they're infinite, right?
Yeah, again, this is a great representation of how Thelema evolves into like chaos magic.
Okay, that makes more sense. Here we go.
So numbers are infinite and numbers are not infinite. People are stars and infinite, and people are not stars and infinite. They are independent and they are not independent. And basically, as I hope we'll never talk more about, but I'm sure we will on this podcast, the central idea behind chaos magic is essentially having in your mind these different gods, philosophical and religious systems that you are able to call up at any time in order to perform your will, and then you just let them go. You just
so it's
stop
like
believing
schools
in
of
them.
Magic.
Exactly. Sort of. Yeah. They're schools of magic, but the thing about schools of magic is that typically schools of magic are reflections of each other and not contradictions of each other. And you do one, you do the other, maybe you do both. In this case, they are contradictions of each other and both of them are quote unquote true in such a way. This is really heady stuff, people. I'm really sorry about that. I promise it. I can't promise that it'll pay off in the end. I think it does. I think it's really interesting. But now
Me
there's
too,
a lot.
Buddy. Me too.
There's a lot in chapter one that is basically just setting Crowley up as the prophet of the Aeon, the one who must be obeyed, promising to give him and his followers the rituals and magic in order to needed in order to fulfill the law, and basically everybody has to listen to him no matter what. So that's pretty much what we would expect out of a religious text written by Aleister Crowley. But in verse 20, it says, quote, "Who calls us Thelemites will do no wrong if he look but close into the world, for there are therein three grades, the hermit, the lover, and the man of earth," unquote. Just like in the Rosy Dawn, or the Golden Dawn, not the Rosy Dawn, just like in the Golden Dawn, there are three different levels to Thelema, which again is reminiscent of Rosicrucianism, of the Freemasons, of all of it, these three different levels. So, quote, "Do what thou wilt shall be the whole of the law," unquote. We kind of mentioned this already. This is the most famous sentence in all of Crowley's writing. It has cropped up all over pop culture, which again, I do hope we can cover that in its own episode. But one of my favorite examples is did you ever watch Adventure Time, Jason?
Bits and pieces. Not frequently.
I freaking love Adventure Time.
Well, I mean, like, when it started airing, I was not living with my parents anymore, so I didn't have cable television. Right? Like, didn't it
Is
start,
that
like,
true?
I
no,
feel
man.
Like Adventure Time either
Because I was watching
late into our high school.
It was in our high school. It was my freshman ended. Year, I think.
What? All right, yeah. No, I just never watched it then.
All right, that's fine. In any case,
I've seen
it
a
is
few
a,
episodes here and there, and that's about it.
It is a children's television show. It is also fantastic. I love it. I own four seasons of it on Blu-ray. In one episode, one of the characters, called Magic Man, pops out of the ground and incants, "Do what thou'st will shall be the whole piece of law." So it's like Adventure Time's like, yeah, let's take this chaos magic. Let's take this. Aleister Crowley, foundation most wickedest man in the world, and let's put him on the children's show. And you know what? I respect the hell out of that. That is a heck of a move, and they did it well. Now, this is followed up by the very, very next verse, which is, quote, "The word of sin is restriction. O man, refuse not thy wife if she will. O lover, if thou will, depart. There is no bond that can unite the divided by love. All else is accursed, accursed. Accursed be it to the eons, hell." Unquote. So, if do what thou wilt is the law, the very antithesis of the law is restriction. Do not what thou wilt. Restriction is the sin. And like we said, Crowley, especially when we're looking at sexually, has a huge problem with Christianity, as he has ever since he was a little boy. And he uses this to say, you know, you're sitting there talking about sin and sin is this, sin is that. Sin is only the needless restriction of that which is good in life, that which can be used to determine the will, which is in most likely, I would think, in Crowley's estimation, because thelema is practically just sex magic.
Right.
Christianity and other organized religion imposes these restrictions on sexual activity specifically because they know that it is how one uncovers their true will, and they're trying to keep it's a conspiracy. It's a conspiracy. And they're in on it. I don't know who's in on it or how they got in on it or what, but that's what's happening here. Now, on this comment, or on the comment for that verse, Crowley states, quote, "Interference with the will of another is the great sin, for it predicates the existence of another. In this duality, sorrow consists. I think that possibly the higher meaning is still attributed to will. The first paragraph is a general statement or definition of sin or error. Anything soever that binds the will, hinders it, or diverts it is sin. That is, sin is the appearance of the dyad. Sin is impurity. One cannot say it was sin for not to restrict itself within the form of two, but on the contrary, but sin is to restrict the operation of the reversion to not," unquote. See, does that make sense? That we tracking?
No, I'm so confused
that's a,
now.
I know, because it's just more mumbo jumbo. Basically.
Yeah. There are way too many commas. Like, that sentence is just...
Oh, it's huge. Okay, so here's the thing that I've neglected to mention for this entire first episode, is that the one of the core tenets of Thelema is that you don't... It's not Fight Club. Okay, you can talk about it, and you should. Whatever, it's fine. But you don't go around explaining it. There is no one interpretation that is the correct interpretation. And so everything I've said to you, even if it's Crowley's own writings on the matter, is a lie and is false. Because I'm sitting here saying this is what it means. Now, if I was to not say that, then it wouldn't necessarily be a lie. It would simply be an interpretation. So, with sin, with restriction, what Crowley is trying to say in this whole mumbo-jumbo gobbledygook is basically, restriction is sin because it creates a division between that which can be done and that which can't be done. And if there is a division, then what do we lose?
Was that a question?
That was a question. If there is a division, then what do we lose?
My mind.
Yep. Okay. We lose unity.
Ah, that one. That's what I was going for.
Yes.
If you had just given me a couple more minutes.
Just a few more days to rest.
I would have got it.
So he says, quote, sin is the appearance of the dyad, unquote. So in philosophy and religious philosophy specifically, you have the concept of the monad, which is the unified divinity, and the dyad, which is a diametrically opposed divinity. So Judaism, Christianity, they have a type of monad, a single divinity, whereas Zoroastrianism, for instance, has a dyad. It has two all-powerful forces, one of good and one of bad, and they fight against each other. Crowley is saying that if taken correctly, even Christianity, even Judaism, and these other quote-unquote morally restrictive religions should be able to see that because God is unity, there is no good and bad. There just is. And that is why restriction is sin, because it creates an artificial division. And therefore, by creating an artificial division, it encourages people to line up on one side or the other of the artificial division, creating manifold more division, not only philosophically divided, but now corporally, individually, and physically divided as well. Does that make sense?
Yes.
Nice. All right, cool.
More so.
Good. He sees specifically monogamy, for instance, as creating a division between peoples. Monogamy states that this is your husband and that is not your husband. In Thelema, everyone is either your husband or not your husband. Now, that doesn't mean that you're obliged to do anything with anybody, but it means that those opportunities and those options are there. He specifically writes about how monogamy is used to treat women like property, and that to engage in extramarital relations is more akin to property damage in that philosophy than it is to anything else, and argues that to be sexually liberated, to be free to join in with any and all in sexual intimacy, is to break down the barriers that constitute the coup, the artificial selves, which refract the true will, and to pursue unity with that true will. Again, we see that sex is going to play a very big part in the magical practice of Thelema, because he sees it as not just the unity between two people, but the unity between all people. So, there's that. But it is a sexuality which, as we've mentioned, is different. It is more noble than just, as he would say, the pagan, casual, animal instinct. It is more noble than the Christian, restrictive, fear-based institution. Verse 44 of chapter 1 states, for, quote, pure will, unassuaged of purpose, delivered from lust, the lust of result, is in every way perfect. The perfect and the perfect are one, perfect and not two. Nay, they are none. Unquote. It is not simply sex for pleasure, although there's no prohibition against that. Rather, it is pursuant to mystical union. All right. We're almost to the end of chapter one. And then you all can have a week off. And Jason, you just have to sit here as we go even deeper down the rabbit hole in chapters two and three. Too bad. You were like, oh, I'm so excited to I was too. I was like, oh, I'm so excited to record with Jason.
Now it just feels like you're saying words at me.
I'm just screaming through time and space.
Absolutely. Yeah. That's what this is.
Now, the chapter adjures its readers to discard all previous methods of ritual, magic, and religion. Verse 49 states, abrogate all rituals, all ordeals, all words and signs, unquote. And this is the natural conclusion of the equinox of the gods. As you'll remember, March 20th of that year, which I looked it up, the equinox is the 21st. So it was actually the day before the normal equinox. So we got that one wrong. March 20th of 1904 was the equinox of the gods, when Horus rose to power, unseating Osiris, who had previously unseated Isis. Because there has been this change, starting on March 20th and going forward, the rituals of religion past are no longer sufficient. Which is interesting because, of course, Crowley's entire life to this point has been emulating the religious rituals of ages past, whether they are the Abrahamic, whether they are the Eastern, or even whether they are the ancient mystery schools of Egypt and Mesopotamia, where they would he and MacGregor Mathers and everyone, they would act out these rites. He's saying all of that is gone. We need a brand new system. And who's going to give it to us? It's Crowley. Aleister Crowley. Yes, indeed. Indeed. We know the previous two eons were, again, the age of Isis, and that is going to be the Mother Earth sort of age, the natural, like, the paganism and all of that. Then you have the age of Osiris, which is the dying and the rising god of Christianity and other things like that. And now you have the age of Horus, which theoretically, so according to Crowley, the age of Horus is the age of a child. It is the age of innocence. All that is done in pursuit of the will, regardless of social taboos or restrictions, is pure and worthy. Even if it's not necessarily, well, again, there is no good and bad. So as long as you're acting towards your will, you are acting correctly. If you incorrectly pursue your will, so long as you are actually pursuing it, your actions are made correct. Good?
Yes.
Okay, good. The first
chapter. It's all about the will.
It's all about the will, baby. Will Smith. Get him in the movies. You'll notice that there were no movies with Will Smith between 1904 and now. We're in the age of the will, and it seems like he's everywhere. In Gemini Man, he played two characters in the same movie. That's magic to me.
That's CG to other people.
Well, potato, potato. Now, the first chapter ends with a preview of the rituals of Thelema, which will seek the unity of all things. Verses 61 to 63 state, quote, oh, this is a long one, quote, but to love me is better than all things. Again, this is Newt speaking. To love me is better than all things. If under the night stars in the desert thou presently burnest mine incense before me, invoking me with a pure heart and the serpent flame therein, thou shalt come a little to lie in my bosom. For one kiss wilt thou then be willing to give all. For whoso gives one particle of dust shall lose all in that hour. Ye shall gather goods and store of women and spices. Ye shall wear rich jewels. Ye shall exceed the nations of the earth in splendor and pride, but always in the love of me. And so they shall come, so shall ye come to my joy. I charge you earnestly to come before me in a single robe and covered with a rich headdress. I love you. I yearn to you, pale or purple, veiled or voluptuous, I, who am all pleasure and purple and drunkenness of the most inner sense, desire you. Put on the wings and arouse the coiled splendor within you. Come unto me. At all my meetings with you shall the priestess say, and her eyes shall burn with desire as she stands bare and rejoicing in my secret temple, to me, calling forth the flame of the hearts of all in her love chant. Sing that rapturous love song unto me, burn to me perfumes, wear to me jewels, drink to me, for I love you, unquote. Finally, verse 66 states the manifestation of Nuit is at an end, and the first day and first chapter of the Book of the Law was completed. And that is the exact ceremonial instruction of what to do when presiding over a Thelemic mass and gathering. So there's that.
Yikes. Okay.
How do you feel? Is this the magic you were hoping for?
No.
Sex magic?
I understand the drinking part now.
Yeah, I'm actually about to crack open a beer for part two because I don't think I can do this anymore.
Perfect. Let's just wrap this up next week.
Next week in the listeners' minds, yes, but for you and me, we're doing this for another hour because I got stuff I need to do next week.
Oh. I'm just going to go back to eating my chocolate rabbit and put me on mute.
Mute thyself.
Go.
You know where to find us. Facebook, Instagram, podcast lands, desolate mountaintops.
That's where I want to be.
The deepest trenches. You know who we are and what we're all about. And so remember, is it my turn or your turn?
I don't remember. How about
I'm just going to say it's my turn.
Go for it. You got it.
Remember, whether you are journeying into the desert to take your fill of love under the stars, or you are journeying downtown to an unused conference center to take your fill of love under the stars, you are not alone.